Okay, I just want to talk a little bit before lunch in half an hour. In a way, what we did last weekend was really to do a lot of consolidation and really looking at the poem, looking at the kind of processes that we've been through. And I just want to take it forward a bit this weekend by looking at coming back to this whole idea of looking into the imagination and looking in a way, partly right now, looking at what's happened to our cultural view of the imagination and how it makes it hard for us to trust these internal kind of senses. And that's partly why we spend a lot of time looking at some of these old poems, old ideas, medieval images, trees of life, all the rest of it, is because we're looking at cultures and times when people really understood how to work within their senses and the imagination and take it seriously. And one of our big problems, eternal problem really in studying this subject, is it's really hard to trust our senses, really hard to trust and take seriously our own experience of ourselves and our own experience of the world, because everything in our culture discourages us from doing that. You know, we're in the middle of an election campaign at the moment, it's just started. And it was interesting that a lot of people saw the politicians standing up there I didn't see all of it, I saw a little bit of it, where people all the different parties are standing up trying to convince us that they're best somewhere. And one level you watch them, your heart sinks really, these are the leaders. And you just think, oh my God. But it's interesting. I mean, things like elections are cultural events, right? Then they show us things. They show, well, what is our culture? What is, God help us, actually, what is our culture throwing up at the moment? And what I was struck by change, because the very fact that there were seven people standing there and not two or three, like three normally, I suppose. So suddenly you see, actually something's changed here, and there's all kinds of reasons why that's happened. But suddenly there's seven people standing here. That's never happened before. And I think that's interesting. And it's not that I particularly liked what they were saying. Didn't really. I mean, mostly for the Greens and the SNP, actually, and even Plaid as well. The women, actually, it's interesting. The women were much more impressive than the men, I think. Right, and that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, again, so that in itself was interesting. So there's something about diversity. There's something about coalition politics, which is new, because that's where we're headed again. We're headed to another coalition, unless something extraordinary happens. It's not that I'm a great fan of coalition politics. I've watched it in Israel for years, and what it means, one of the things coalition politics means, that extreme parties have more power, and life because the coalition government and the government needs their support. So I worry about UKIP, and I worry about Farage and the hidden agendas underneath that party. But what I also worry about is, and you can really see it in spin, because the hope that this word spin, I've been thinking a bit about it, and thinking about, I don't know when, I mean, I associate really with the Blair, with Blair and Blair and the coming of the Blair government and New Labour and kind of, and I'm not sure it was quite early on before, but it somehow gained new impetus, and it's just, and in a way it's interesting because spin in the way they're talking about is to spin out of. And we work with this image of the spiral and the straight, which takes you down and in. But spin spins you out towards the surface. And the thing that is interesting when you look at politicians, and you think of politicians as imaginal figures, they're very shiny. They're very practiced, they're very polished. It's the gloss of the surface. It's the gloss of the world of advertising. It's that place where the imagination, the creativity is directed, and that kind of the will, the intention underneath that is directed to produce a flawless image that you'd want to buy. And again, it's, you know, commercial culture is at the heart of our society, right? So it's all about buying. What do you buy? Now, what they were doing when they all seven of them stand up, you know, is they're wanting us to buy them, to buy their image, to buy their ideas, to buy their, to, and to give our lives over to them, give the direction of our society over to them for the next so many years. And part of so then you think, well, and I think, what happened to us as a culture that this happens? Because, you know, if you go back to the sort of, because we are one of the most class-ridden societies in the modern world. The place where, I go back into my own political roots, into left-wing activism, and, you know, and I just look at the roots of things of the Labour Party, but not even just that. Actually, I'm not making a sectarian point. If I think of the libertarian wing of the Conservative Party, which, you know, lots of things I didn't personally agree with, but had a real commitment to ideas of liberty, and had images of and also conservation. And if you go back beyond the world of spin, there are all kinds of people abroad in politics, many of whom I didn't like, of course, because politics is always sectarian and polarizing. But there was a sense of personality and of greater sense of authenticity in the people. If I think of even something like Norman Tebbit, right, as some of you might remember, I don't like Norman Tebbit at all, right? But I have a feeling for him as a person that I find very hard to get off current political leaders. And there's something about the place where people are no longer allowed to be individual and have to present a spun party line. Now the problem with that is it infects the zeitgeist, it infects the age that we live in, so that the desire to be perfect and flawless. I hate them, but I've even had some sympathy, not sympathy exactly, but interest in some of the UKIP candidates, because they're terrible in terms of spin. They say the terrible thing, and they mean it, and I don't agree with them, and God knows I don't want them in power. But there's something about, I've been thinking, well, at least, I don't like what you stand for, but at least I know what you stand for. I know you're some bawling old racist who's going to try and do something, but I have a sense of you as a person. There isn't the layer of gloss which stops me knowing who you are. Now, the problem with that layer of gloss is that it's easy to point fingers at politicians are just, you know, they're sitting ducks in some ways, so it's easy for me to talk like this. But the thing about it, that idea, that layer of gloss, that wish to be flawless, is I identified it myself as well. And it has a lot of relationship to this idea of hiding parts of ourselves, hiding who we are. Becky very eloquently talked about an aspect of it, and Susie did as well, hiding and revealing. And sort of, so, but the problem with some of these processes is we end up hiding from ourselves. Because whatever we're doing, whatever stuff we're working with here, what we're really looking at, if we look at these two ideas of the Awen and the Anuven, with Anuven we've got this idea of trusting the deep inside us, not the surface, the deep. And Awen is this mysterious creative will and directionality that we find in ourselves when we go into the deep. There's like the power of life pushing up from inside, pushing us in different directions. I was reading something, there's a 16th century letter by somebody that's in the Bodleian Library, and it was about Englishmen looking at the funny Welsh, basically. And because there's a lot of antiquarians used to do this, sort of look at the funny Welsh, funny Irish, funny, you know, funny Northerners, you know, this sort of, you know, so the people come out of London, and it's the beginnings of anthropology in a way, and it turns eventually into the discipline of anthropology. But it starts off with people, travellers, looking at the funny Welsh. But in these quite raw kind of antiquarian accounts of peoples and how their odd ways, you sometimes get really interesting accounts of how what people were doing. And one of the stories really that in this letter is of him being told a story by somebody who had received the gift of the Awen. So it's about like a 16th century letter. And so somebody's telling him about his nephew who received the gift of the Awen. And what this person did was to go and sleep up on the mountain, and then had a vision of a young man with a crown of oak leaves on his head, carrying a bow and arrow, and having a hawk on his hand. And what happens is the visionary man with a crown of leaves lifts up his hand and sets the hawk off, and the hawk flies towards the nephew and flies into his mouth and flies down into his belly, and now he has a hawk living in his belly. Now it's a small thing, right? But it's powerful. Now, if you've read this as an account of a North American medicine man or a South American shaman, this is the kind of thing you would read as a shamanic initiation. You know, power animal, visionary encounter. You go off into the wilderness. You go off into the jungle. You pray, you go searching because you go searching for something, and then a magical figure appears, and then a power animal flies into you and now lives inside you. Now you've got to nurture the hawk. Okay, so but this is happening in 16th century Wales, and it's happening in 16th century Wales because these things we call shamanic or magical or archetypal, imaginal, are a central part of human nature. And they happen everywhere. Now, the difference is that in a shamanic society, that experience could be talked about, would be worked out, would be held not just individually but by the community. And so that shaman, that person who has the hawk in his stomach, would be encouraged to take that literally and seriously. But literally, now you've got a hawk living inside, you've got to look after the hawk. That's part of the deal you've made with the spirit creature who's come to you. So the encouragement would be then to keep nurturing the hawk, keep listening to the hawk, letting the hawk speak. Sometimes the hawk would get you to behave in unusual ways. But it would be taken seriously. You'd take it seriously, and people around you would take it seriously. Now, in 16th century Wales, there was enough understanding of those things, and the world hadn't closed over yet, so that it's still taken quite seriously. This particular person became quite a famous bard, and had a lot of, and you know, was treated as such. He was treated as a significant, a serious thing in that generation. But by the time the guy is being told the story and writing it down, it's become a funny story. So we're talking, it's a generation later, because somebody is talking about somebody in the previous generation. So the reason that letter is kind of quite important in some ways is you start to see, one, it's a very powerful, very clear account of something that is before the Druidic revival. It's before, you know, it's before all the 20th century stuff about the recovery of shamanism. It's an authentic, straightforward account of something that we can see as a powerful shamanic encounter. But it also shows us a nodal point in a culture where something is starting to really, has managed to survive to quite a late time. Talking 16th century, you've gone through the end of the Celtic tribes, you've gone through the dominance of Christianity, but underground you see that something continues in a really direct way, not just as an individual process, but as something that the community valued. Now, these things never stop emerging because they're intrinsic to human nature, I think. And certainly that's my experience. So when I come to sit in Craigavon Park, anticipating the return, the boy goes home. October. They'll be rejoicing in the streets. I'm sensing it. I'm feeling the love. Perhaps I'm not remembering it very well. Could be another problem. But when I come across this, right, so I have this thing, I mean, I have these strange, as a kid, I remember these strange images, these strange experiences, things I can't make sense of, but powerful things. I mean, one of the things I remember as a very small boy is having this shape in my mind where I could, all time, I mean, it's like a shape, I can't put it into words, that all time happened at once, past and present and future was all one shape. If I went into this shape, I could feel it was all going on at the same time. And also, I sort of felt that everything, all human beings were connected with each other, or not just human beings, everything was connected to everything else. That was also a shape in my mind. I didn't get that from anywhere, it was just there, it was just sort of, you know, and kind of, so I sort of had to learn the different relationship to time and space as I grew up. And it's a struggle, because it's like sort of, you're fitting yourself into something and you're thinking, okay, it doesn't really make sense, because this how it works, got to work in, And you say things and people laugh, particularly my family, people laugh at you or just tell you you're wrong. So basically what happens to you, what happened to me, is a continual experience of being told that these things which seem to be really central to me, really at the heart of my experience, were just wrong. And feeling silly and feeling humiliated and kind of, what in me was appreciated by the people around me was the fact that I was really bright, very good at school, all of that stuff, learned to read very early. You know, so learn, okay, that's the bit that you concentrate on, and that's the bit that seems to work, and don't know what you do with the other bit. But the other bit, for me, was held by this little everyman paperback translation of the Mabinogion. These extraordinary stories and images that we're looking at, that spoke to that other place. And I didn't like it because I'm Welsh or because it represented Welshness. I have a really ambivalent relationship to Welshness because Welsh is not my first language. My family, my father's family are very Welsh and they were all horrible. So it's not easy for me to deal with Welsh. So that wasn't what attracted me. What attracted me was there was something speaking out of those images, those stories, that somehow connected to this kind of deeper, mysterious place that I couldn't find a place for. So what happened to me, in a way, was probably most of us who have these connections do, is it becomes this private, hidden place inside me that is really important, but I only tell people about it who I really trust, and that not very often, to be honest. Okay, you learn to keep yourself to yourself, because actually what you discover is either people don't get it, or they do something with it, or they make you feel silly or wrong. And that's one of the enormous differences, really, between a society that has that kind of, that values the imagination, that values the imaginal experience. Now, what helps, as well as the connection of the book, what really helped me as I got a bit older was the idea, the image of Carl Jung. I knew him when I was 17. I understood not a word. I have memories of explaining Jung to people when I was 17, with when you're that age, hormone-fueled confidence, testosterone-fueled total knowledge. I really didn't understand Jung at all, but I bet I sounded like I did. Yeah, because it's that, but. What I think, I didn't really know anything about him at all, but what I got is this is somebody who somewhere had become really respectable and somehow knew about these things, and people interviews to young people say, "Oh, yeah, great," and I said, "Okay, if I talk about the mappy dog, I talk about my experiences, people sort of back slowly away. You talk about Jung, okay, you can do that, people like that, okay, cool, I'll talk about Jung." Although sometimes it went badly wrong. This is really embarrassing, but I can assure you. I had an interview for Hatfield Polytechnic. I didn't really want to go to Hatfield Polytechnic, but by God, I made sure I wasn't going to go there. Because they asked me what I was interested in, psychology. I was very interested in psychology. I didn't understand. So my problem, because I was very misinformed by my careers teacher in school. That would be my dad we're talking about. My dad was the careers teacher. He was such a manipulative man, he never gave me proper information. I thought psychology would be all about Jung. Right? I didn't know that it was nothing to do with Jung. It was all behavioural stuff and sort of anyway. So I was going to be, to study psychology at university. That's what I was going to do, and kind of learn all about Jung. I didn't know that it wasn't the case. And I went to Hatfield Polytechnic because what I also did at my A levels was I totally screwed them up. My rebellion against my family finally emerged when I was about 18. I'd passed everything up until that point, so I spectacularly failed all my A levels, and then I had to repeat the year because everybody was determined I was going to university. There wasn't going to be another choice. Somehow I couldn't stand it, So I'm applying to Polytechs because it's quite clear Ian isn't going to do well at A level because I was studying physics, chemistry, and zoology. Why in the name of God I chose those subjects? I think I was made to. My father wanted me to be a scientist. My thing about my father is that he wanted to be an engineer and was made to be a historian, so he had to study history and English. Hated it, wanted to be a scientist, and wanted me, therefore, to fulfill his dream. For he wanted me to be, I was much more naturally inclined to the arts, that's really where my energy is, but I was made to do sciences. So one, I wasn't very good at it, and two, I was fucked if I was going to do it, because it would have meant giving in to him. But so consequently, I ended up Ian's going to Polytech, Ian's not clever enough to go to university, and dum-de-dum-de. And And anyway, so I go off to, I know this is happening consciously, I don't know what I'm doing, but I go off to Hatfield Polytech, and she asks me, what am I, psychology, and what are you interested in? I'm interested in Jung. What are you most interested in Jung? So then I explain my theory, of the Jungian basis of ritual magic and the summoning of demons. I thought it was quite a good theory, and it's all about how demons are dissociated parts of ourselves, and you summon them into the triangle, and probably if I'd been talking to an actual Jungian, that might have gone all right, right? But what I'm actually talking to is an academic behavioral psychologist interested in studying reflexes. So we're not getting a meeting of worlds here. So I'm thinking I'm quite safe, Jung on my side. I'm telling you all about magic and the smile's getting more and more brittle as we go along. And of course it all goes wrong, So there's a sort of. But actually, the point about that story in some ways is. I was spot on. I was spot on about Jung. But what I wasn't spot on with was the world I was working with, which was not a Jungian world, not people. It was actually a behavioral psychology world that was all about surface. Now, I mean, anyway, I ended up doing psychology at Cardiff eventually and actually it was all right. I learned how to do it. Seemed to be what was on offer in my life. I learned some useful things about it, but I didn't learn anything about depth. I think we probably did have one lecture on Jung in the entire 4 years, but mostly it was all about measuring people and learning how to do that, and learning actually how to bullshit. That was the thing you learn when you're a psychologist. You learn about something called the experimenter effect, which is how when you measure people, the way your involvement in it massively alters the measurements. And so you learn about that in the beginning of your psychology training, and thereafter you behave as if it's never happened, and as if everything you're doing is objective. So the world of spin, the world of advertising, actually has a lot to do with with the development of behavioral psychology. In fact, a lot of behavioral psychologists found very good jobs in the development of advertising. Now, what that means is, so in a certain sense, that what I'm trying to navigate, right? So is how do I retain a sense of connection with these kind of deeper places? And so it becomes private, I thought I'd found somewhere, I thought I'd found Jung, and I had found Jung, I was right about that. But actually, our culture didn't really value Jung. And so I wasn't, unless I was, didn't have the money, there wasn't the right kind of class to go and find the kind of places where that kind of training would happen. So I ended up going to the, a fairly low-key university in Cardiff that wasn't that good, really. But, it did, But what it means is that for me, one of the things it meant was that there's two split worlds. So I then developed this life as a psychologist. At the same time, I'm training in the Kabbalah with Ernest Butler and Tom, and I learned to split those worlds. So I learned to divide myself. And I think that's what happens, right? So we end up with this hidden life, and you end up with this outer life. And never the twain shall meet. So it's interesting today when we begin the meditation. And again, these things I always just do spontaneously. I start asking people to bring your outer life into the mound. And of course, parts of us don't want to do that. You want to get away from some aspects of that outer life. Because in part, you are relating all the time to a culture that values some parts of ourselves and doesn't value the deeper parts of ourselves. And in particular, doesn't value independent creativity. And in a way, that's got worse in our lifetime, I think. There's lots of things I think that have got better. But what's got worse is this place where development of spin, the development of that kind of flawless image that exists on the surface, and that I see the roots of that in the development of advertising and the way in which psychology collaborated with advertising. People may have heard of Abraham Maslow, who is this great humanistic psychotherapist, and he's thought of as being this great, you know, really somebody who really helped people individualize and value individuation. He was also one of the principal advisors to the development of advertising advertising in the States. He used the Maslow's hierarchy of needs to help advertisers target people. So there's a sort of corruption isn't too strong a word. Well, it's probably too strong a word, but it's a splitting. It's a way in which you can use understanding to deepen, or you can use it to manipulate. Now, what it means for us as we study this, I'll end on this because we need to go to lunch. But what it means for us as we study this subject, what it inevitably means is that we come into our own internal splits around this, our own internal manipulations, where we've had to where some parts of us feel more acceptable because they fit with our zeitgeist and are rewarded by it, and other parts that we feel that we have to hide or somehow don't fit, unless we can find an external shape that supports it. Now, what we're doing in all of this is using some external shapes, stories, images, tree of life, whatever, that can help us make a bridge between the world that we live in and what seems to be value there and these deeper places. But in the end, we have to find and value our own deep will, our own deep creativity, and find a way to bring that out and let that change our lives. And that process is all held somewhere in this spiral diagram, right, where we keep working with it. And the thing about the spiral diagram was we keep going round and round these things, keep working, keep bridging, keep doing the business. And at any time, and we don't know when, that straight run through is going to happen. Can happen in a moment. It can happen in the story of Ceridwen, right, I'm giving up my craniosacral practice. Or it can happen in I have a meeting, and I see something about hiding money. It's that you can never know when that's going to happen, and so you have to keep trusting the spiral kind of process, and somehow the greater, in a way, it's like there's two spirals going in different directions, right? Where there's the spiral that can spin you out into the flawless image, who you're supposed to be, what the culture wants you to be, or there's this deeper spiral that spins you into the places where you can align with this deep sense of will. That can kind of change things. Now, oddly, just a big one final figure to bring in, right at the beginning of Greek civilization, just take a total jump, there's a guy called Empedocles, whose vision of the universe is that there are two spirals represented by two goddesses. And the one is the outward spinning spiral represented by the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love, who is the bewitching figure who enchants you and binds you. There is this other spiral, which he calls the spiral of, this is the energy of love, but which he's using in a very particular way, not in the way we might think of it. There's this other spiral, which is about the energy of death, ruled by strife, the goddess Persephone, the death goddess. And Empedocles, who is this great teacher, says, I take mad strife as my guide. I take the energy that breaks things down, that destroys, because it frees me from enchantment. It's the freeing of the prisoner from the chains. We'll hear more about Empedocles as we begin. Empedocles is the first person to create an image of the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. That's his other great contribution to the development of Greek thought. So he gives us these two images, these two spirals, and then these four ways of creative expression through air, earth, fire, and water. But he says to us, take mad strife as your guide. Take the place of dying, of letting go of things, and of freeing yourself from the external image. Now, in Greek society, Aphrodite is the image of everything that's beautiful. But in his way of understanding it, she is the external image. She is the place that takes you into the place that is flawless, the image of perfect beauty. The deeper beauty, he would say, is in the hidden goddess, Persephone, the goddess whose beauty comes out of a deep place and is always individual, is not stereotypic, is not generic, and who reveals the actual beauty that is found in you, that the world cannot see and doesn't reward. The world asks us, he would say, to be like Aphrodite, to mould our bodies, to mould our minds, to mould our hearts in a recognisable shape. And in order to get free of that, we have to work with mad strife, the energy of loss, the energy of destruction that takes us into our true beauty. And in a way, what we're doing here is finding the way to do that through different methods. Now what we'll do is find the way to get to lunch.